Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagho Mradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today is Brian Roselli, the Vice President of Strategic Missile Defense at Raytheon Technologies, one of the world's leading experts on missile defense, a growing challenge in this great power universe where China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran are developing ever better and more precise long-range conventional as well as nuclear strike capabilities. Brian, thanks so very much for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here today. Thanks for having me.
An absolute pleasure. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Brian, we've got a new administration taking office, and obviously it's a challenging world. Everybody's recognized that, you know, as Bob Work used to say, developing longer sticks. And as a result, the United States has to develop longer sticks itself, which I know the Raytheon company or Raytheon Technologies now is working on, but then also better missile defenses. Let's start with the threat. Whether you want to start it at the strategic level or anywhere else, even though I think the lines for what is strategic, regional, and tactical are very much being blurred. But talk to us about the threat and how we have to think about the threat if we're going to counter it.
Sure. Thanks, Vagho. You know, I think that over the last few years, there has been an acknowledgement from the U.S. and our allied partners that the overall, say, the geopolitical environment is changing. And along with that is the threat to the U.S. And that really has had some significant influence on how not only governments, but industry does look at defending ourselves against those threats. In general, we've seen a shift in posture from being more worried about rogue nations and asymmetrical warfare. Well, over the last 5 years or so, we've seen a rise of near peer or peer nation states, and as well as significant leaps in technologies and threat capability. You go back 10 years ago, I think there are very discrete and specific problems we were trying to solve, which were very much focused around in the missile defense arena in ballistic missile defense. And over the last 10 years, we've seen an increase not only in the overall quantity of ballistic missiles, but we've also seen a change in the overall capacity, not only in what a ballistic missile can do with a more cluttered scene or maneuvering reentry vehicles, but we've also now seen increases in technology with things like hypersonics, longer legs. The threats are being able to go further and put more emphasis on CONUS defense. And then on top of that, you've got the issues of proliferation, where missiles and missile defense is becoming more of not a single point solution. But we're starting to have to worry about threats from submarines, from mobile launched sites, as well as fixed sites. And that all just complicates and challenges the problems that we have in missile defense. And I think you can go back 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, where the Missile Defense Agency actually kind of altered their mission from ballistic missile defense to actually talking about missile defense in order to deal with this change in the overall environment.
Right. Well, so, you bring me to the next point, right? That blurring of tactical, I think that was in 2019, where the Missile Defense Agency started to talk about transnational threats instead of just regional and national. And in a hypersonic world where there are long-range conventional ballistic missiles, that line among tactical, regional, and homeland gets blurred. And in fact, I think in some respects, right, we've come full circle. Missile defense was strategic in the 1950s, then became increasingly tactical. And now we're going back to the strategic. But Brian, we're still on the wrong side of the cost curve, right? Adversaries, most of our solutions have been tailored to small numbers of weapons coming at us, right? The National Missile Defense System was a handful of interceptors in Alaska to protect against the North Koreans, or a forward missile site, Aegis ashore now in Poland, in order to be able to deal with something that comes from Iran. Whereas now we're looking at greater volume, right? And deterrence works only as long as the adversary can't do math, right? Like if they figure out, wait a minute, we have more $200,000 missiles than they have $10 million interceptors. How do we need to think about architecturally what this solution looks like so that there is no say-do gap between what we envision and what we field, given that that is a key to deterrence ultimately?
Yeah, Vago, that's a great question. I'm going to answer that probably in a surprising way. And I'm going to start by saying that I think missile defense begins with nation-state diplomacy. And it starts with economics and partnerships and kind of getting, and I'll get to your question about the overall economics and the cost curve to begin with, that you started with in a little bit here. But you know, you talk about an overall architecture. Well, the threat has become global. And whether you're talking strategic or tactical, the global nature of that threat really then starts with diplomacy. And that not only means diplomacy with your adversaries, but it also means establishing appropriate international partnerships, collaboration, and bilateral, multilateral agreements in order to address specific outputs. And I think that becomes very important because you talked about sort of the cost curve. Well, missile defense is a pretty expensive proposition. You're looking at, hitting missiles with missiles or bullets with bullets, as the expression goes. And the technology involved in keeping up with the changing in the capabilities and capacity of these threats, it does take investment. So I always like to start the discussion about how do you set up the architecture by acknowledging the fact that the threat is global, that it requires partnerships, and it requires investment. And when you think about the threat being global, it means that you need to have multiple layers. You've heard that expression before, I'm sure, about layers of missile defense. But the layers are kind of horizontal and vertical to me. On the horizontal side, you need to be able to detect threats, whether strategic or tactical, as soon as you can. And that means perhaps even left to launch before something actually gets fired off. And that takes surveillance and reconnaissance type activities. When a launch is detected, you need to detect it early because early detection develops time for solutions, for decision-making and those sorts of things. And then you also, as the threats get more complex, you need to continue to evolve your ability to track and have custody of that threat wherever it's going, whether it's in a strategic intercontinental perspective or a tactical perspective, and then following through from a terminal solution. And so we need to look at not only partnering with our allies in order to make sure that we have access to information, that we have access geographically to be able to get those early looks, to follow through the course of the whole track custody of flight. And then depending on where it's going, work collaboratively to solve the problem. And that to me is the horizontal lens to this, but there's also what I call the vertical lens of layers. And that means that the solution has to be driven by a terrestrial or ground-based. You have to have layers in there that are air-based, as well as now we're talking space-based, in particular with counter-hypersonics, so that you can get some of the earliest looks and pervasive custody as you go. And again, coming back to your question about the overall economics of this all, having to have the layers, having to have the whether they're the horizontal layers or the vertical layers, it certainly means having to partner with different nation states. And from my view, I think there's value in collaborating in cost share, in sharing technologies, as appropriate, and whether that's government to government or, as authorized through policy and State Department, obviously from an industry perspective, We really enjoy collaborating with you know, other nations as well. I would like to just give one good example of that, and that would be the Standard Missile 3-2A, where it was a joint development between the U.S. and the Japanese, where Raytheon worked with MHI and have developed a missile that has recently been proven to be able to evolve into a multi-mission missile that does intermediate ballistic missile defense, but now also has evolved to help counter intercontinental ballistic missiles. So that's just kind of an example of that value proposition that comes from nation state sharing and you know, that diplomacy and economic aspect of this.
How much, Brian, of what we've developed is applicable to the hypersonic threat, especially hypersonic either point strike or area denial, right? That presents an entirely different series of challenges than what we've faced. And then the added complexity is we need a new space layer, or that's the consensus view that we also haven't been investing in because it's expensive to do. You know, how much of what we have is applicable to that threat? How much new has to be developed to deal with it?
Yeah, we're going to see a little bit of both. I like to talk about revolutionary and evolutionary technologies. And when you think about the evolution of missile defense or threats, where you need a strong missile defense, we are going to see both evolution and we are going to see revolution. In terms of counter hypersonics, you know, the first and most important thing is being able to close the fire control loop. And that means being able to detect, it means being able to track, and you know, having the appropriate command and control in order to follow that, to develop a firing solution and have effectors that can go after and neutralize the threat. I will tell you today, Brian Roselli's opinion is that we have capabilities across the US to be able to do that. But the question then becomes, is it enough to address the volume, the continued, you know, the continued evolution of the threat and the economic piece? And I think that's where we're going to see more revolutionary technologies. You talked about the space layer, you know, certainly having a lot of attention there right now. And as I said earlier, that provides the ability to detect early and provide that track custody. But I think we're also going to see revolutions in command and control and communications, because hypersonics, the speed of a hypersonic effector, means the decision-making process is going to need to increase. The latency of decision-making has got to reduce. And so we're going to be, I think, seeing revolutions in artificial intelligence, as an example, machine learning, to help us not only process data, but also support decision makers in how to respond. And ultimately, you know, I see a revolution in you know, perhaps on the sensing and the effector side. You've mentioned things like directed energy, rail guns. Certainly, they have a place, a part of this this game to play here in a couple of years, as the technologies continue to mature and the capabilities, the defensive capabilities there, continue to advance. So we're going to see I think a whole mix. And, you know, coming back to your question, I think there's some fundamental capability that exists today, and we are going to continue to evolve that capability to deal with threats, but also very excited about some of the revolutionary things that the government and industry is investing in that will continue to help with sort of the game-changing elements of this, and as well as looking down the cost curve.
And let's talk about some of that, right? The interceptors today are very good, but they tend to be very expensive, right? I mean, it depends on what you're targeting and what you're protecting. But in a volume situation, we've tended to, again, sort of focus on the golden bullet side of it as opposed to the volume problem, which is the realization we've had over the last several years. The Ballistic Missile Defense Agency is working on its next generation interceptor, and I want to get your thoughts on that. And to the audience, Brian and I were talking about the role of lasers and railguns. So, Brian, thanks very much for folding that into the conversation rather elegantly. So talk to us about some of these revolutionary capabilities, and how do we change the cost model on this, right, and work down to less expensive individual interceptors or an overall network? What's the role of commonality, for example, to try to take cost out of the system, right? I mean, what's the way for us to be able to do this, given that we have a tendency of not wanting to spend as much as we might need to spend in order to solve this problem or address it as adequately as we should, right? So the whole question then is how to get more bang for each available buck.
Yeah, no, it's again a great question and very pertinent. I'll use effectors as a way to try and illustrate and keep this discussion going. And to me, it comes back first order to the layers discussion we've been having. You look at the ballistic missile defense system today, or the missile defense system today, and it does have a significant number of layers. You start out with ground-based interceptor, GBI, which is developed for very advanced intercontinental ballistic missile threats. These things are, they're expensive missiles or effectors, but they also, in comparison to the role that they play, protecting the U.S. homeland from a intercontinental ballistic missile and the damage that could inflict, you have to kind of take that into consideration. We say, well, how expensive is this? But beyond the GBI, you then start having layers like the Standard Missile 3, the THAAD interceptor, which are designed kind of as either an underlayer or for intermediate range missiles, perhaps less damaging, a little bit more cost, from dollar per effector, the cost starts coming down. And you can come all the way as you get closer to more of a tactical missiles with Standard Missile 6 or Standard Missile 2, the Patriot system with GEM-T's and MSE. You've got these different, capabilities in an effector in these multiple layer scenario, and you have different price points with each of those. And so one of the things that we want to be able to ensure through strong command and control is that you're using the appropriate effector for the appropriate threat. An example of that would be you don't want to use a ground-based interceptor, a GBI, against a medium-range Scud missile. Now, that's a perhaps a silly example, but trying to illustrate, you don't want to use a very expensive and capable system against a less capable threat. And so being able to make those right decisions and having a integrated system that allows you to make those choices, I think, is important. But we're not done yet. And what I mean by that is we continue to have to look at ways to make products cheaper. And in my mind, that means having a very robust supply chain. It means working through volume. I mean, there's economic order quantities. We don't make, to your point, we don't make missiles at the same rate that we make iPhones. And as a result of that, the overall quantity or lack thereof sort of drives up the price point. So commonality in systems, I think, becomes a very important piece to being able to drive the cost down. Again, having a robust supply chain, ensuring that there's industrial diversity and that you have lots of options. I think sometimes vertical integration can be counter to the overall reduction of the cost curve. And then at the end of the day, we get back to those technologies, the revolutionary technologies. A laser might have a non-recurring cost to develop. But in principle, once it's in place, the cost per shot is fairly low. It's just the energy required to energize and cause the effect on the threat. versus a missile where there obviously is a recurring cost that gets consumed every time you get it's fired off. So yeah, I think that overall there is a huge focus on trying to manage the cost equation of missile defense. I think first and foremost, it's being able to address those layers and tying it back to using the right effector against the right threat. It also includes continuing to work on the systems today through the supply chain, through volume, through ingenuity and product development to reduce the cost. And then finally, there will be those game changers that are going to come in and provide other solutions with significant reduced cost per shot type solutions.
Do you, you've been in this game for a long time, both from a program management standpoint, but now as a senior executive and thinker and architect, if you will, for some of this. Do we need to have sort of a more global allied approach to how we approach missile defense, integrated air and missile defenses? There's a tendency of seeing it as sort of 17 Patriot customers around the world, a number of THAAD customers. You mentioned Japan on the standard, a longtime partner. We have other partners, obviously not for that model, international partners on the standard missile. Do we need to have a better integrated view, given that those allies and partners are forward, right? The sooner you detect, the sooner you shoot, the closer you are, the more successful you are. We're talking about agile basing. It's unclear to me whether we're going to move a unit before a hypersonic missile can hit it, for example, right? So forward and having those defenses forward and integrated are key. Do we need to have a different kind of mindset? Does the administration maybe need to approach this from a broader perspective, seeing as how the Biden team does want to look at more global solutions to complicated problems, whether it's China, Russia, or climate for that matter?
I'm a huge proponent of international collaboration, and I think everything you said is spot on. Whether it's conducting joint exercises, and we are seeing more joint exercises today than perhaps 10 years ago, those are wonderful opportunities to be able to show the integration and jointness, fighting together. And they also do a great job of highlighting where some of the gaps are, whether it's in command and control or movement and shifting those sorts of things. So I think we have seen the governments, our governments promoting and working more joint exercises, bilateral agreements or multilateral agreements on the development side seem to be on the rise. And as I said earlier, I think that's good for two reasons. One, we'll get more diversity in thought in solution space, but I also think that there are significant advancements or enhancements in the economic picture of there too. But I think the last piece that you hit is right when it comes to the interoperability and the ability to move a unit, say it's a Patriot battery from one location to another, and not only having it integrate into U.S. forces, but being able to integrate it into to our allied forces, and be able to help provide that larger, provide that defensive picture. Is very important. And there is a lot of energy going in right now on how do you better integrate the different U.S. force structure components, but also how do you integrate with our allied partners? And I do believe that's going to continue to pick up momentum under the today's leadership. And for me, that's an interesting and exciting challenge to be able to work with our allied partners, whether it be on the on the CONOPS and military engagement side, but certainly also on the industry and partner development, production, and side of the equation as well.
as let's bring the conversation full circle. You know, new administration is coming into office. Obviously, they're looking at a whole series of reviews that Secretary Austin has launched. What would be, as somebody who's been in this game for a while and seen each administration sort of take its own approach to this, ultimately, what are the keys to success for this new administration? What's the advice you're giving your friends and counterparts in the administration to sort of think about how to address this problem on their watch?
You know, every new administration brings new opportunity. And unfortunately for the U.S., the threat is not getting any easier. And I think any administration will come in and take a look and recognize that the strategic and tactical threats against our nation continue to increase. And as a result of that, I think there's a quick recognition that missile defense needs to be a priority. And I believe it will remain a priority. How it is rolled out may change a little bit. The posture, of partnership with the allied nations will have a different flavor, perhaps a different programs. You know, some programs may have in higher favor than others. But at the end of the day, I believe that this administration is already acknowledging that missile defense is an important capability and priority. And while they might take their time and looking across the portfolio of what exists today, I still think that there will be adequate and sufficient focus on missile defense threats and how do you solve that. And my recommendation to the incoming administration is really the same that I would have for the prior administration, which is we need to continue to focus our investments on evolution to deal with some of the near-term gaps that we might have, but also keep investing in the research and development and the and bringing forward those revolutionary technologies. And I'm excited because it seems as if the new administration has a nice balance there with understanding the need to evolve for the near-term threats, but also making bigger commitments towards research and development and some future game-changing activities. I also am excited about the posture of the international collaboration. We've talked about that a lot here today, Vago, and I'm passionate about the impact, the positive impact that can bring for the U.S. and our security.
Brian, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. It's an absolute pleasure. Look forward to continuing the dialogue with you on an important topic at an important time. Thanks so very much for joining us, and all the very best to you and the Raytheon Technologies team. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.